You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 21st of September 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 272 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
Coming up on the show today, we talk to a former French diplomat and foreign policy advisor who's attempted to write the definitive history of Gaza.
Then we hear of the challenges to getting an artist's life and work down in words when we speak to biographer Christopher Simon Sykes, who's just published the second half of his biography on one of the greatest living painters ever. Well, kind of. David Hockney.
And then by the end of today's show, we'll speak to Sam Bompas of the artist duo Bompas and Parr. This time, they've shifted their attentions away from jellies to mind-altering plants and botanicals, Andrew.
Anyway, it's all that. Plus, of course, some new music as well. Coming up on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Yes, it's a Sunday lunchtime, Andrew, and you know there's nowhere I'd rather be than right here in Studio One with your very good self.
Thank you very much, even though you did make a noise by brushing a large copy of Monocle by your right hand.
This is the October issue, soon to be on newsstands, on newsstands now.
Yeah, on newsstands since Thursday, and it's a beast.
Listen to it. Oh, you can hear even all the different paper stocks and inserts and all sorts of exciting.
That's worth the money.
There's two of these.
Get off my knickers! No, it actually, ladies and gentlemen, that was two rubber bands holding in the supplements. Tom's gone pink. I don't want to have done that.
I'm flushed. I'm absolutely flushed. Well, also, it's because... we'll get onto that. I've been furnished with a warm beverage. I like to have a nice fresh coffee when we're tackling the Monocle Weekly. Ooh,
from the Monocle Cafe, I might
put. But look who's brought it in for us, Andrew. It's none other than Tom Reynolds.
Tom Reynolds, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, listeners to the show may know that Tom Reynolds is, well, he's kind of managing editor for the magazine. He sits opposite me and he deals with me and Tom all day. And unfortunately, over the last couple of weeks, has been dragged into the show without being here to account for himself.
So we thought we'd give you an opportunity to speak out in your own... So the not defence, exactly.
Yeah, no, defence. First of all, you know, we were talking here on the radio the other day about... that you've got a pink suitcase.
Mm, yes.
And you blamed your granny.
Well, blamed. It is actually hers. She won it in a raffle.
And where was the raffle?
It was at the local golf club.
Okay.
Brickendon.
But we've mentioned it a few times, because also I think you cropped up because of your hat that you sometimes wear.
Never worn. Only been forced upon my head.
Well, you've still been wearing it.
No, but we have talked about your... Well, actually, because you get very sensitive about the hat story.
Well,
you would, because you do not look like Stan Laurel, and anyone who says that, it's super, super mean, especially with a pink suitcase. It's not comedy at all.
I just think I'm a bit more, you know, I'm a character actor, so you say, if you said I look like anyone, I'd be able to...
Oh, sort of chameleon.
Yeah, exactly. And the sooner you say Stan Laurel, a picture in my head, put the hat on and do
Al Pacino,
the face.
Could you do Al Pacino, do you think?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Now, we're doing the Monocle book tour, and you're kind of coordinating actually everybody's manoeuvres.
Yes.
But you're coming with us.
I know. I can't wait. October the 1st, Istanbul.
And so if we've got listeners listening in who are in Istanbul, we're doing a party at the New Vault Hotel. And all of our subscribers are heartily welcome. And anybody who's got the wherewithal to buy a book, actually, I'm sure they'd be welcome
as
well.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And Tom Reynolds will be there.
Yes, I will. And come and say hi. Be nice to meet you.
You'll recognise him because we should say there's an informal Laurel and Hardy dress code. So he'll stand up.
Now, after the very mean taunting of you borrowing your granny's suitcase, will the suitcase be coming to Istanbul?
You see, it is the perfect size for a short trip, which makes me want to say...
You should have the confidence.
Yeah, but no. Definitely not. It's gone. It's in the skip. Threw it away. Soon on my way home, I'd carried all my clothes and shoes home with me and just chucked that in the nearest skip by the building site next to Midori House.
What's Granny Reynolds going to say when she finds out about
that? She doesn't know. She doesn't have a clue.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're going to get to know Tom Reynolds over the coming weeks. We're going to have him as a regular guest and telling us about how to look natty, how to look stylish, and the benefits of a pink suitcase.
Now, you're Andrew Tuck. I'm Tom Edwards. We heard from Tom Reynolds I think we should hear from another Tom. How do you feel about that, Andrew?
Tom. Let's go for it.
To the Tom Club.
Yes. Who should we have in? We should have Tom Lewis or Thomas Lewis.
Lucky for you. Here I am.
What a
glad
joy.
To be of service, gentlemen.
Now, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Andrew. It's always a pleasure to be here. It's been a bit of a while, it feels like.
Well, you've been up in Scotland.
I have, jaunting around.
But now you're back, and you are going to look ahead to next week's news today. A role, indeed, Thomas, that I like to play myself, but as you can see, I can't this week.
You're a man of many talents, Tom, and I'll be honest, it feels like there are some very big shoes to fill.
Good.
Because there's quite some big news.
Say that one more, once more with sincerity. I've never seen a lack of sincerity in anyone's voice like that.
I'm the sincerest guy in town, I really am.
Have you got very big shoes? What size foot are you?
They're like, you know, those clown shoes.
Okay, off we go.
Plenty of big business to look at next week. So the General Assembly of the United Nations kicks off next week. Wednesday is looking like the big day. President Barack Obama, David Cameron, Francois Hollande, they're all making their big pitches. And this all comes at quite an interesting time domestically for each of those leaders, I suppose, as well as this collective response to the ISIS threat that was begun in the NATO summit in Wales. So it'll be interesting to see what each leader decides to use as their... use their moment for, I suppose. I mean, you look at Prime Minister David Cameron, of course, has had the Scottish referendum on his back for the last couple of weeks. President Obama has had a lot of trouble with an apparent U-turn on immigration policy, with the midterms coming up in November, of course. And then President Francois Hollande, of course, no vote of no confidence early this week in him being put through the parliament there. So, I mean, these are always kind of interesting glimpses, I think, into these leaders' lives, because it really is sort of a big family portrait of all of the world's leaders, really, in New York.
I imagine quite a few of them actually rather like getting away to do some big, you know, high stakes diplomacy, nice bit, a few bilaterals away from the sort of pressure cookers of domestic politics. You mentioned just those three, Cameron, Obama, Hollande in particular, less than 15% approval rating. Quite literally the worst ever of any French president. It's probably rather nice for him to be, you know.
But the strange thing is, for the group shot, he has to be at the front, doesn't he? Because otherwise you wouldn't see him.
That's true.
He could do that thing that like kids do when they kind of stick their heads through their adult's legs. You could see him kind of like popping through Obama's legs.
Or run from one side to the other. I don't know if they use those old-fashioned cameras anymore. It's all high-tech now. It's all digital now.
Exactly. Would it be him picking his nose to the left-hand side? I don't know.
What else is happening, Thomas?
So plenty more. Let's go to Africa then for our next story. Mali is celebrating its independence tomorrow, on Monday, the 22nd of September. 53 years as an independent state. And it's obviously been an interesting... couple of years for Mali. It's been through some real trauma, but also has had maybe some positives that the international community has sort of gleaned from that. Of course, the French intervention, was it late last year, to rid the Islamist scourge in the north, and the ongoing sort of rebuilding really in Mali that's taking place there. So I think, you know, you get a sense that actually there is a sense, either through its music, which is obviously very famous, or through its other sort of wider social fabric, that process of rebuilding itself is really going to be a very long process, but actually that it has begun.
One of the nicest things I think about Monocle 24 is where we have correspondence based, and we have an amazing correspondent in Mali, Alex Duval Smith. And it's strange when somebody's just good at doing their patch. You know, I feel that I know more about Mali than I think any other African country, because she brings it to life in such an extraordinary way. And I also, it's just, I think the characters who make up foreign correspondence, you know, here's someone who is based in Cape Town. She's dotted around the world many times, but she was based in Cape Town, and she decided to go to Bamako. That would be a more interesting place to base herself. And, you know, these people are not, you know, worried about the pool or the view. They're worried about, you know, telling stories. And she's an amazing voice to have on Monocle 24. So it's interesting to follow everything about Mali, partly because of her for me, though.
And I'm sure we'll be speaking to her tomorrow on one of our live programmes here on Monocle 24 to see how the day is being marked nationally.
Don't bang your knee on the desk.
I've got very big knees. It's always big shoes.
So excited about Bamako.
I really am.
Okay, next.
Okay, next. Where should we go? Oh, let's go to the US then. On Friday, the 26th, a very big visit taking place in Washington, D.C. India's new Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, is visiting the White House. Now, this is pretty remarkable if you think of, well, how remarkable his victory in India's general election was anyway, but also what that meant for the relationship historically with the US and his group that he was a part of, that's now the political party. It'll be really interesting, I think, to see what the nature of these talks are. I mean, of course, you know, there are handshakes and the pleasantries and the niceties, but actually I think there is a sense from Washington that this is a new chapter for India and that it would like to be a part of that, potentially, when you look at all of the other focuses of China and the Southeast Asia and those other focuses the US is trying to put out there. But actually, maybe there's a sense that India hasn't quite figured in that strategy so far, and that this meeting at the White House, which is historic, you know, it will actually be a fairly significant one, rather than just the pleasantries that these international visits usually have.
Well, and there was a big diplomatic spat, wasn't there? I can't remember this earlier this year or last year. And so it actually called into question whether this sort of high stakes diplomacy between the leadership would actually happen at all. So I guess that's another good news story in and of itself for both sides, probably.
Absolutely. And you think of how testy that whole scenario was of the ambassador to the UN, I think it was essentially expelled from the US, and how frosty relations became. But I think when you've got a figure like Prime Minister Modi in India, who does seem to represent so much, both politically, socially, for the economic future of India, whatever, you know, side of the post you put your political colours to, that actually maybe that spat, which was a big story, but whenever it was, like you say, last year, start of this year, maybe pales a little when actually there is now a new start to be had.
Thomas Lewis, thank you very much. What an excellent journey through the next week.
I do try, you know, to hold you both by the hand and lead you through the week's news. And that's I try.
I want to know what they're going to have for lunch, because he's quite a strict vegetarian, isn't he?
He is. Yes. I don't know. I'm afraid they haven't posted me the menu. It got DHL a bit slow.
And Barrett Lance at Barbie. So that's going to be a kind of, you know, clash of the tongs, I think.
Corn on the cob. Can't go wrong.
No, you can do nice vegetables on sticks.
You can.
All of that. Vegetable kebab.
I'll send them through the menu.
Thomas Lewis, thanks very much for joining us here on The Weekly.
The world's attention was focused on Gaza earlier this summer as thousands died during Israeli military action in the territory and counterfire from Palestinian forces. As intense as this global scrutiny was, it was relatively short-lived. And this story is the familiar bleak pattern when it comes to the history of this embattled strip of land.
A new history of Gaza, from its beginnings through to the turbulent current days, aims to correct that and bring to the world's attention an authoritative account of Gaza and its people. Well, joining us now from Paris is Jean-Pierre Filieu, Professor of Middle East Studies at Sciences Po and the author of Gaza, A History. Hello, Jean-Pierre, and welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Great to speak with you. I just wanted to start by asking you whether this book is necessarily a political history or whether it fits into a broader social and economic history. How would you categorise the book that you've written?
Well, first, it was a very demanding book, and it's an ambitious book, and I'm not sure, I hope, I lived up to my ambitions. I wanted to explore what is a very seldom known field of Middle East history, which is a focus on Gaza. Gaza usually was considered as a sideshow. But I also wanted, on a more personal basis, to pay tribute to the wonderful people of Gaza, whose history has been too often reduced to a string of tragedies.
Jean-Pierre, could you also explain to us, you talked there about the tragedy of the people of Gaza, but the contemporary story we know is of these 200,000 Palestinian people who moved to this strip of land in 1940s. Tell us about how that happened and how that began to shape the modern vision of Gaza.
Well, my book tried to provide a long-term history, an historical perspective into the dramas of today. So as you just described, in 1948, 200,000 Palestinian refugees fled into a land around Gaza that will become, after the ceasefire between Israel and Egypt, the so-called Gaza Strip. So this word is interesting because a strip is what is left of a territory. And the Gaza Strip was left of Palestine after most of it had been absorbed into the modern state of Israel and the rest annexed to the modern Kingdom of Jordan. So on this strip of land, 200,000 Palestinian refugees met, joined and amalgamated with 80,000 local residents. Today there are 1,800,000, out of them 1,200,000 refugees.
And can I ask you, Jean-Pierre, a little later during the 1970s, when we saw, began to see the development of the sort of political bodies that would become Hamas, do you think there was a miscalculation by the Israelis because there was an awareness of the risk of secular nationalism within the Strip? They understood what that could mean for the Palestinians more broadly. And so they were actually happy to countenance the growth of Hamas because they viewed it as an evil they could live with almost.
Certainly. So this is also the history I wanted to write, which is a history of lost opportunities for both Israelis and Palestinians. Israelis never envisioned something like the Gaza Strip because in their initial Zionist plan, there was nothing that would be left of Palestine after the establishment of the State of Israel and the deal with the Kingdom of Jordan. So they were really adamant in repressing and crushing Palestinian nationalism. And when they occupied the Gaza Strip in 1967, and it was already the second occupation because they had briefly occupied it for 4 months in 1956, at this moment they were faced with a long-term, grassroots, low-intensity guerrilla. And after the defeat of this guerrilla, they promoted, they fostered an Islamic current that they thought would be the best antidote against militant nationalism. But obviously, like all the various occupiers, they couldn't fathom the risk of promoting such an Islamist alternative that would later grow and be known as Hamas, which in Arabic is the acronym for the Movement of Islamic Resistance.
And tell me, when we look now at the today, we always imagine that Fatah represents a kind of a slightly more liberal version of the Palestinian cause, if liberal is a correct word, while the Hamas is more diehard and militant and Islamist. But actually, the people underneath both of their rule, if you took the average person in the Gaza Strip, do they conform to those stereotypes, or are the people of Gaza and the people of West Bank just Palestinians, just refugees, probably more united by their views than we think of when we see these leaderships in the two different areas?
Well, this was one of the main challenges among the other challenges facing me while writing this book. I had to deconstruct the party narratives of both Fatah, which is the main Palestinian nationalist movement and the backbone both of the Palestinian Liberation Organization and today the Palestinian Authority, whose siege is in Ramallah and president is Mahmoud Abbas, on one side, and on the other side, the party narrative of Hamas, who is now ruling the Gaza Strip under Ismail Haniyeh as his prime minister, with Khaled Meshaal as leader of his political bureau based in Doha, Qatar. The reality is that those two movements share a very deep, intimate, common history until the confrontation of the 70s in the very Gaza Strip that intensified in the 80s and that led to the formation of Hamas as an alternative to the nationalist PLO and Fatah. But even at that time, it was through the peace process that the two movements really began their confrontation that ended up with a full-fledged civil war in the Gaza Strip in 2007 and the takeover of Hamas. So it's not so much an issue of die-hard versus liberal, but an issue of party politics, with today Hamas controlling Gaza, even through the war and despite Israeli offensive, and Fatah controlling the West Bank. And there is absolutely no hope for the Palestinians if there is no reconciliation between the two parties, which is why the common opinion in Gaza Strip is let them unite, let them reconcile, because we want Palestine. We don't want only the Gaza Strip or one part of Palestine. And we want this reconciliation to reopen the path for a real Palestine that will be not confined to this territory or that.
And Jean-Pierre, you're describing there this incredibly complex situation, even within the Palestinian territories. Can I ask you about the international dimension to this as well, beyond Israeli borders? You're a former diplomat, but you mention in the book that the US has been responsible for active interference. The EU also, you say, has been too passive when it comes to dealing with this. What responsibility do you think, with your diplomatic hat on, the likes of these other actors, the USA, the European Union, what responsibility should they take, certainly for what we've seen this last summer within Gaza?
Well, I think Gaza Strip should be at one of the top priorities of diplomats worldwide, not only Western diplomats, but UN, and generally everybody interested in the peace process. Because when you think about it, Gaza Strip is not such a complex issue in terms of peace negotiation. You don't have any Israeli military presence left in this Palestinian territory, and there is no Israeli settler in situ. So the issue is about coexistence. The problem is coexistence should be between parties that recognize each other. So since Israel doesn't want to speak to Hamas, and the reverse is totally true, then they have to go through the Palestinian Authority and to restore the path to this Israel-Palestine two-state solution in order to lift the blockade, but also to demilitarize the territory. I deeply believe a win-win deal can be achieved in Gaza between the Israeli legitimate demand for security and the Palestinian legitimate demands for normal life. But to achieve that, diplomats have to be a little bit more imaginative and innovative than they have been until today. The Americans should stop just unconditionally support Israel. And Europeans have the possibility to help monitor the border checking points with Israel, but also with Egypt. And what could be even more important, to sponsor a much-needed sea line between Gaza and Cyprus, which would be the best way to diffuse the attraction of the militias in the Palestinian territory, because now the level of unemployment is such in the Gaza Strip that there is barely no other future than getting a gun and fighting with it for a young Palestinian kid in Gaza.
Jean-Pierre Filieu, Professor of Middle East Studies at Sciences Po in Paris and the author of Gaza History. Thank you very much indeed for joining us here on the Monocle Weekly.
Now, in a very short moment, we're going to be speaking to the biographer Christian Simon Sykes, who's written an authorised biography of the painter David Hockney. But first, we're going to have a song, and it's by a British artist who's from Liverpool and who used to be the backing vocalist for Paloma Faith. And this is Jetta, not to be confused with the Volkswagen car. It's her track, Crescendo.
That was a Crescendo by Jetta. Nice little mover, Andrew. So yeah. Well done there. Very clever. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
Getting an artist's life and work down in words is a tricky business. How much life? How much work? What about the naughty bits? When that artist is David Hockney, perhaps the greatest living painter, you've got a bit of a juggling act on your biographer's hands.
And in this case, that biographer is Christopher Simon Sykes, and the second half of his authorised biography of David Hockney is out now. Christopher joined you, Andrew, and Robert Bound a little earlier to tell them all about it.
It was mostly done early on in when he was still in Bridlington. Uh-huh. He spent the last year in LA, so I caught him before he left. And yes, so it was done in his studio. He's got a fantastic studio there, one in his house, which is on the top floor, sort of proper artist attic studio. And then he's got this enormous industrial unit, which is thousands and thousands of square feet, where he was able to lay out the great show for the Royal Academy.
And is seeing the studio, it's one of those things before you start the conversation, maybe we all do this as interviewers, you kind of want to check out where an artist works. A studio for someone whose work is visual, not like a writer's desk perhaps, can tell you so much about your subject. Did you kind of keep the small talk running while you kind of clocked what was going on in the studio itself?
Yes, well, my eyes were, of course, you're absolutely right, darting around, noticing, first of all, how incredibly clean it all was, and very, very different to the photographs you've seen of Lucian Freud's studio, which every single surface was covered in paint. Hockney's studio is meticulous, all his brushes beautifully kept in special pots, and all the paint laid out in drawers, and very neat and tidy.
And that you can sort of, you can, I mean, you can see that, you can maybe guess that from the painting.
Yeah.
So you can see like Freud's heavy oils and Hockney's kind of tight control of his medium. I guess that's in there. What about to speak to? Is he as controlled as his studio?
No, he's, when he gets talking, he's so engaged with what he's doing. He just goes off on an incredible journey into talking with the great enthusiasm about his work. It's inspiring to talk to him when he's like this, because he's so engaged in what he's doing and he wants to fire you with the same enthusiasm he has. So when, for example, he took me on a drive, he started off by saying, what colour is the road? And I said, well, it's grey, tarmac-y colour. He said, I'll ask you that question again in a couple of hours. Then he talked to me about colour and how your eyes initially just see one colour, but if you look, there's colour in everything. And then he said, as he promised, what colour's the road now? You know, and I said, well, now I do see, I've seen some purple in it, you know, and a bit of orange.
Christopher, can I ask you, the amazing thing about Hockney is that journey he's made over the past few decades, that he's carried along with him the public and the critics, on most instances the critics as well. And normally an artist who is, you know, enjoyed and found accessible by the public is sneered at by the critics, or it's rare for somebody to pull both audiences along. What is it you think that's special about him, that, you know, that people do understand his paintings emotionally and instantaneously almost, but they still have the depth that, you know, appeals and lets us call him in the introduction the greatest living artist?
Well, I think, you know, even his, I mean, he does obviously have his critics, but I think even his harshest critics acknowledge that he's a great, great craftsman. You know, it would be hard to argue that he isn't one of the greatest draftsmen in the world. I mean, I think you know, his skill at drawing is quite extraordinary. And he, in my opinion, one of his great legacies will be his extraordinary sketchbooks, which very few people see because they're kept in the archive in Los Angeles, and there are books and books and books on them, and they record every day of his life, really, and he's never without a pencil, and it's fascinating to watch him drawing, you know, because he draws so sort of simply, and yet he knows exactly what he's doing.
Me and Rob were talking before we just came on about his kind of national icon status, you know, and we joked, you know, that the similarity...
You're going to ask Christopher to do his Alan Bennett David Hockney impersonation.
But we were thinking, there's people of a generation, Alan Bennett, Elton John, there's something oddly that kind of links these people that kind of sit in the public mind. Is he comfortable with that idea of being a person who is kind of held in that kind of opinion?
He's completely uninterested in it, is the truth. You know, I mean, he was offered a knighthood. He turned that down. It means nothing to him, really. He doesn't... it's not that he doesn't really think about it. And he's only interested in one thing, which is his work. And he doesn't really care what people think. He minds what he thinks about things.
And was he pretty free with, you know, you quote from letters to, you know, to Kitage and all sorts of people. Was he free with giving you access to his papers?
He wrote a letter authorising all his friends to talk to me and answer any questions I put to them. And he let me free access to
and they
archive.
Hated that.
Well, they did all, I have to say, they did all check back with him. Right. That was the point at which I was worried, in case he was going to change his mind. But he never did.
And the book is as we said in the introduction, is in two halves: a rake's progress and now a pilgrim's.
Yes,
progress.
It wasn't ever supposed to be in two halves. That's because I couldn't finish it in time for the Royal Academy show.
That's a nice way of putting it. I like how we go from Hogarth to Milton. Is that the sort of shorthand, Christopher, from a rake to a pilgrim?
Well, actually, the idea for the title came directly from Lord Gowrie, who I was interviewing him. When I was interviewing him, he said, the thing about David is he's a pilgrim. He's always on the journey forward. And then I thought, well, that would be a great title for the book, A Pilgrim's Progress. And then when it was two volumes, I thought, well, we'll start with A Rake's Progress, because he was quite rakish in his early days.
Let's face it.
You know, and he's an interesting... I mean, one of the things... I'm giving a talk in October at the Rydale Festival in Yorkshire. And they said to me, we'd like your talk to conform to our theme. And I said, well, what is the theme? They said, courage. And I said, well, that's very interesting, because actually Hockney's life has been a lot of it about courage, particularly in the way that he fought on behalf of gay rights, you know, in the early days, and was never frightened to come out as being gay at a time when it was still illegal.
And there's a lot of, there's a lot of sex and sexiness in those, in that first batch of LA paintings as well. But I always tend to think that that was something that kind of won some of that battle for him. Yes. Without his verbalising of his sexuality, it was there on the canvas, and there was obviously fairly infamous parties and things. But that was something to make something that people were perhaps frightened of, make it look so good.
Yes,
it couldn't be all bad.
Yes,
you know?
I mean, particularly the Cavafy poems that he illustrated, you know, they are incredibly beautiful. And it was interesting that when that programme was done, 100 works of art or something on the radio a couple of years ago by the director of the British Museum, 100 of the world's greatest works of art, chose one of those drawings as being a very important and, you know.
And tell me, the lives in Los Angeles and the lives, you know, here in England, are they lived in a way, when he goes to America, is there a sense of him not wanting to be in Britain, of leaving behind things? And vice versa, when he comes back here, is there a sense that he needs to get away from Los Angeles? Or are these two places, you know, friends? Sometimes it feels that he needed to kind of leave as well.
That's a very interesting question. I mean, he left England because he was fed up with England, but also I think just to get away from... I think his mother was a very controlling influence in his life. I'm not suggesting he left England to get away from her entirely, but it's quite odd that he didn't come back till after she died. And then he came back and was intending, I think, really to stay here. And then after the terrible tragedy with his assistant, two things. First of all, he had a minor stroke after the big show at the Royal Academy. And I would say probably from overwork, he'd worked so hard. Then his assistant died. And I think those two things knocked him so hard. He was going to LA anyway, because he had a big show in San Francisco last October.
That was slightly
just
what
I was
alluding
there.
To, because you know, after his assistant died of an accidental drugs overdose, with recreational drugs, and you know, the papers chewed over his life at that point in a way that must have been uncomfortable for a man who, as you said, had lived his life confidently and openly and never been secretive about things. But suddenly his personal life was picked over in a very kind of crow-like, pecking format.
I mean, you know, and that's really why he hasn't come back, because he knows, and of course it's going to happen, that as soon as he comes back, there was a time, I don't know, 6 months ago, when word got out he was coming back, and there was immediately something in the Daily Mail about him, and he just said he wasn't coming, because he knew that it would just all be about, they'd be raking it all up again. And it did hit him very hard. He was very depressed for a long time. And he, you know, couldn't draw. He could only draw, he couldn't paint.
So for a second time in his life, Los Angeles does provide... oddly, a safe place.
Yes, and since he's been in Los Angeles, he's done an amazing series of 50 portraits. You know, he's thrown himself into his work. He's a very different man now to the person he was when I was interviewing for the first volume. He's less loquacious. He's a bit frailer. His energy is still there, but he's, you know, he's more reflective, I think.
That was Christopher Simon Sykes, and the second half of his authorised biography is out now.
Up next, we'll be joined by Sam Bompas of the artist and architectural duo Bompas and Parr. They've got some new edible tricks up their sleeve. We'll find out exactly what after this.
Nothing compares to a handmade wooden yacht, so say Bodrum's boat builders. Monocle travels to the Turkish port city to film the century-old skills still at the heart of the country's boat-making business.
The wooden bullets, they have soul. I don't want to say the other ones don't have any soul, but it's different. We fall in love with the wooden boats and we give our soul when we build the boats. It's like an art, every small piece done by hand.
Boat Builders of Bodrum, a cinematic portrait, now playing on monocle.com.
Artist duo Bompas and Parr have achieved fame for their unique work, which to begin with consisted of making jellies and gelatine desserts in various elaborate shapes and sizes. Some of their best-known works have included recreating London's St Paul's Cathedral in gelatinous form, a fruit-themed boating lake, and mooring a ship in 55,000 litres of neon green jelly in Bristol.
But the latest project is not about jelly anymore. Starting this weekend, the pair can be seen in London's wonderful Kew Gardens, hosting an event called the Plant Connoisseurs Club. What's in store is a selection of unusual plants from curious and culturally significant ceremonies, we're assured, different medicines and items for the audience to taste. Some mind-altering plants and botanicals, I gather, have been mentioned in this context. Well, joining us to tell us a little bit more is Sam Bompas, accompanied by... well, various plants and accoutrements. I don't quite know where to start. We'll get onto that in a minute. But Sam, welcome back to Midori House. Good to see you again. And welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Tell us first of all about the origins of this project first up. What are Kew Gardens doing? Because they're looking at intoxication sort of broadly. Is that the idea?
So Kew Gardens has spent the summer looking at poisonous plants. And we started off looking at that. And we actually thought, well, you can't really give people a lot of poisons. Is there something that we can do that are looking at sort of cultural poisons? We all have poisons in our own lives, personal poisons. But can we get people to sort of look again at plants and give them slightly unusual ones that have a real effect? Now, that was the idea we had a year ago, to look at some mind-altering plants and effectively open a head shop at Kew Gardens. It's then taken us about a year to go through all the health and safety on it, to work out which ones we could do, which would give people an effect, give people an interesting time, but not leave them wandering goggle-eyed through the plants and the gardens.
What was the connection between, you know, the world of jellies and Kew? How did you get a foot through their front door?
Well, you could say it's been a slippery slope or something. We start off with jellies, and a lot of the problems that we had with jellies, they were very small. We're looking to give these people, you know, incredible bodily experiences. We found that we could answer through scaling up experiences to a much grander scale. And last time we did just that at Kew Gardens, and then they were looking at edible plants and flowers and created a fruit salad boating lake opposite the Palm House. And you could paddle out to a pineapple island. We were vaporizing banana mist clouds that you could contribute to one of your five a day through your lungs and eyeballs. And what's more, we worked with the sound artist, Mylise, as well, so you could actually communicate with the plants in real time. So what she did was we took all these bromeliads, so pineapple plants, and we wired them up, and we could capture the microelectrical energy in them. And as you touched them, they became, you know, fabulous instruments as well. So you'd stroke a pineapple plant and go, whoa, like turn into this sort of theremin or something. And another one would be a bass drum. And you realise as well, there's pineapple growing on a stalk, and you realise that one pineapple plant just grows one pineapple. And you're there with your pineapple cocktail in hand. And you realise that pineapple plant's been growing for 2 years to give you that one drink. And by speeding up this sort of, like, you know, creating this human-plant interaction like that, the idea is you really start sort of valuing plants. And I guess actually, if anything, we're also giving everyone these wonderful rainbow spectacles. You're going through this banana cloud, you're communicating with the plants, you have these rainbow spectacles on it, which made everything look a sort of little bit sparkly, a little bit rainbowy. You'd look at the dolphin.
It was working very well at this point, I take it.
Great. All the Kew Garden dolphins, the swans in Kew Gardens pond, and the bright white light reflected off the white swan would
I think I'm starting to see where you got the idea for the mind-altering intoxication from, just possibly. Tell me just a bit before we look at some of the bits and pieces you have here about where you kind of do your work then, because it does sound almost sort of fantastical. Are you confined to the lab? Do you have to go and do field work? It doesn't happen, I guess, in a sort of kitchen per se. Or what's the sort of processes that are involved in this?
Well, you have to come to our studio. It's a bit unusual. We've got a kitchen where we do clean work and stuff that can go inside people's bodies. Then we've got a workshop, and it's very messy, and it's full of incredibly dangerous chemicals, which you try and keep very, very far away from the kitchen. But then we do a lot of collaborative work as well with, you know, some scientists, commercial partners, effectively just trying to give people a really awesome time. That's always the end point of the experience, is to give people an entertaining, but hopefully also educational, informative experience. But on that journey, we get to meet some fantastic people. And, you know, over the last week, I've sat down with a macrobiologist. You know, we're working on sort of bioluminescence and bacteria and genetic manipulation. I've been to see the Malteser factory. And you know, the secrets of the Malteser production line, which is all sort of locked off and top secret. You know, and also with this plant, an ethnobotanist who's just on his way out to Gabon. Probably even saying that wrong. It's so exotic as a place. And he's to participate in an Aboga ceremony, and he's going to become an Aboga shaman, which is one of the very powerful plants that we weren't actually able to include. Now, the odds are still pretty strong.
We should describe the scene, Sam, that's in front of us here. So you've got some scales. You have a glass filled with what looks like potpourri to me. You're going to tell me it's not. We have a teapot ready to steam. What's going to happen?
Right, so in front of us, we've got some scales, and these are really special scales. These scales were bought in Germany almost half a century ago, travelled with the owner. They're super precision scales. They travelled with the owner all the way to Woodstock. They've seen a lot of good use in measuring out mind-altering materials. And for you today, they're going to be taking these rather beautiful blue petals, which are actually a blue lotus flower. So they're sort of a water lily flower, which has been used for literally millennia by human beings. It's not illegal, but it does have an effect to sort of stimulate themselves, relax their minds, and also have visions as well. So,
uh-oh. Are you ready for this, Tom?
I think so. I could do with some stimulation and some relaxation. Do I need visions? So I don't know yet. How traumatized am I going to be?
We have from ancient times the image of, you know, the lotus eaters, you know, who would sit around and kind of be, you know, knocked out by the stuff. Is it soporific? Is it, what does it do to you?
If you hold your pulse, if you can find your pulse now, and you can find it in your neck, it's actually normally a lot easier.
Do you have one, Tom?
Yeah, no, it wasn't there for a moment. I'm slightly concerned, but no, lo and behold, I've located it.
So if you measure it over sort of 15 or 20 seconds, and
okay. I've got the big clock there. Let's have
as you're that. As you're doing it, then what we'll do is we'll go back to it, and actually it should speed up your pulse. It's a sort of mild stimulant. But where the really interesting bit is in what's going on inside your head and what you see with it as well. So I'm now sort of pouring out. I've divvied up the portion.
It was 18 in 15 seconds.
Yeah, so what's times four? So mine's 56 in a minute.
72.
Oh, dear. Oh, God.
That's bad for me, isn't it? It only started to go up. Once I started counting it, it started racing. That's the terror. Okay, well, that's, I'm probably on my way
okay,
out
so
already.
We now have the mug. We have the monocle mug filled with the flowers.
So it looks a little bit swampy. It's a little bit daunting.
Well, I'm sure. Beautiful colours, though, I think.
I'm sure there are better ways to steep it. The Egyptians would actually steep it in wine, which it's pretty bitter. And I've got to say, you'd ruin any good wine if you.
How much of this do we need to drink to get an effect?
All of it.
How quickly does it have an effect?
Pretty quickly. You should have a little bit of something, a little stirring quickly.
Shall I stir it? And then also, definitely, once I drink it down, do I just drink the fluid or the whole caper, including all the plant?
Well, that's really up to you. A lot of people, when they drink it, they then eat the steeped leaves as well.
Tom, don't do that thing again where you took all your clothes off.
But you can also.
I've got to stop doing that at work.
You can do a few other things. You can also smoke the leaves, and you can also use them as an incense.
It's really hot.
It's probably, yes.
That'll be the boiling water, Andrew. You need to watch out for that.
I'm just pouring it everywhere now.
That's all right.
It's disgusting.
Is it?
So it's quite bitter, but.
It's more like I feel like a grazing cow. That's the issue, I think.
I'm going to give this a go.
We're hoping that the effects definitely offset.
I think that's rather nice.
I'm getting a flush.
Isn't that quite nice?
And I'd say it's like some almost sort of chamomile-y, herbal tea.
I think that's nice.
Shall I tell you what you should be watching out for later on?
Oh, I'm just going to enjoy some leaves as well.
tell us.
So with this, your pulse will speed up a little bit. But what it's really noticeable for is you start getting an enhanced sense of vision. So, you know, feel the walls around you, all the objects in the studio sort of caress your eyeballs as you start drinking it and ingesting it. Yeah. What I particularly like, which I've not had before, so hopefully you guys can see this, but I'd really like to see it, is apparently it's useful for giving people auras around them, so you can see identify your aura.
My own aura or Andrew's aura?
You'll have to look.
I think this is quite a lot to get down. So we should tell people, how can they come along if they want to do this event? Is it a ticket still available or are you sold out?
Absolutely. If they go onto our website, which is bombsonpar.com, or if they go onto Kew Gardens website, they can track down a ticket. There are also an awful lot of other things that we're going to try as well, and obviously went through incredibly rigorous health and safety with this. It was, you know, it took 5 minutes to conceive the idea, and then months and months and months of going back and forth. Then Q had their toxicologists, we had our ethnobotanists and toxicologists, and we spoke to everyone, like, you know, right, all the experts throughout the NHS. And actually, the thing that I really loved is they all got really excited about it. A lot of the toxicologists that we're talking to, they were like, "This is brilliant. At last someone's doing something really, really interesting with these plants that have an effect." You know, they spend, a lot of the toxicologists spend a lot of their time not looking at this. In fact, worrying about people's Labradors who have eaten the wrong plants and are being sick all over the house. So this is a really sort of interesting time for them to put their sort of expertise to good use.
And were there any mishaps along the way? You mentioned this rigorous process. I mean, were there any moments where, you know, it was a bit dicey in terms of what you're going to be allowed to do, or in terms of, I don't know, you presumably test all these things on yourself?
Is Mr. Parr still around?
he's
in hospital as we speak.
I did get him to try some things that weren't his favourite. I mean, we went through some kava, which is, you know, mildly soporific, which is used in Fiji and Vanuatu. He thought it tasted like ditch water. I think he couldn't eat for a couple of days afterwards as well. I was rather partial to it, actually.
Nothing wrong with ditch water here and there. I have to say, I drank my Blue Lotus. Mm-hmm. I drank that down.
You've got some vegetation left in there.
There's a little bit of vegetation. I feel extremely relaxed. Shall I test my
test your pulse?
Okay.
Oh, we're trying to see if there's still life there. He's got his finger on his throat. And we're waiting. It's medical science being done here on the Monocle Weekly. You're still with us, Tom?
20. So it has risen.
It's changed.
By a couple of beats there.
It wasn't remarkably changed.
And how's your aura?
I don't know. My aura feels... should I be my aura or your aura? I don't know.
Other people. I think there's one other thing that you should bear in mind with this, which maybe is going to be telling later. It's also known as a powerful aphrodisiac, too.
Oh. Get ready. Get ready back in Walthamstow. Oh, wonderful stuff. I feel revitalized.
Okay, well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. I would encourage everyone to go along and have their glass of, lotus leaves. Tom loved it.
It's working for me still as we speak.
But for now, Sam, thank you very much for coming to see us.
Andrew, my pulse is still definitely racing, and I think I can sense your aura in the room now as a result of that.
Well, we must point out that we're talking here about Bombas and Parr, not about my presence in the room. Well, I must also point out that he's an atty dresser, isn't he?
Very, very, very nicely attired gentleman, yeah.
I felt a bit of a, scruff next to him.
I felt positively underdressed.
He came in with a velvet bow tie, nice jacket.
Highly coloured trouser.
Yeah, well, that trouser was a fashion trouser. That was a... things going on. That was an explosion of
pretty
things
impressive.
Going on there.
Well, it's amazing. And he had his his scales, as he was describing, all of his extraordinary concoctions. There is a sort of a... I'm sure he wouldn't thank me for the comparison, but it's a kind of a Willy Wonka-esque, notion.
I think next week, neither of us should wear our onesies.
Oh, do you think that... Is that why he's looking at me funnily? Maybe. Maybe he was.
That's why he could see your aura, I think. Anyway, I think before it gets any worse, we should probably start thanking some people around
here. We should, because that's all for this 272nd edition of the Monocle Weekly. The show was produced by Marco Sippi, and our studio manager was Joel Church and Clara Barn. We'll be here again at the same time next week. I think you might be, Andrew. I'm not sure if I will be, but maybe I'll be doing my news look ahead.
I'm definitely going to be here. Wouldn't miss it for the world. But from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.